to be in England now that April's there. And in 2012 in London, the scene is not nearly as idyllic as in Browning's verse. The great metropolis is in the final throes of preparation for the Olympic Games and the Royal Jubilee Festival. It has not gone without notice, though, that the city was host this week to the annual London Book Fair. Headlines reaching us from across the pond recount contract signings for Caleb Carr and for a volume on big data from the founder of OkCupid, the dating website. And among the many panel discussions, a gathering of CEOs was not all sunshine and light. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, CCC's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they get back to work on Monday. And this week, joining us from the show floor at Earl's Court in Kensington, London, at the London Book Fair, is PW Features editor Andrew Albanese. Welcome back, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, we do hope you've been having a splendid time there in jolly old England. And tell us about what's been going on at the show.
Well, I've been having a lovely time here in jolly old England. And all in all, it's been a pretty good year for the London Book Fair. We won't have actual attendance figures for some time because the numbers have to be audited and they don't release, pre-show or pre-audit numbers like they do for some other fairs. But, you know, judging from the fairly strong traffic in the main hall, along with a large Chinese contingent, China was the guest of honor this year. It certainly seems like this year's attendance is going to top the 24,800 that came to last year's event. And Monday's edition, we're going to have obviously a lot more coverage of the London Fair. But, you know, I'll share a few highlights with you now since I've got you. Some of the big-name authors. It was a fair in which we finally saw the return to some big authors coming out. And William T. Vollman, for example, is a favorite of mine. And Eric Larson, both signed with Viking. And as you mentioned, Caleb Carr is going to be back with his first new book in many years. And that's going to be published by Random House. And then a big deal that harkens back to the days of, you know, big deals at Wright Fairs, which we haven't really seen in a while. Crown gave Christian Rutter, as you mentioned, the founder of the OkCupid dating site, a reported seven-figure deal for a book that I think is titled Dataclysm, which I kind of like. And it's a book about how data is transforming everything from politics to dating and certainly publishing. I don't know if publishing's in the book, but it certainly applies. So it sounds like a very timely work from Mr. Rutter.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, it wouldn't be a book fair in 2012 if there weren't some panel discussions about the future of publishing. I like to say that if there is a future of publishing, Andrew, it's panels talking about the future of publishing. But in any case, this year we had a digital conference preceding the fair, and you attended and were struck particularly by one presentation.
Yeah, you know, there were a few notable moments this year at panels, and especially at the Digital Minds Conference. You know, I was really taken with the talk by Jim Griffin, who's the managing director of, you know, a technology firm called One House LLC. Jim spoke about what he called the Tarzan economics of the digital age, where companies, you know, cling desperately to the vine that's keeping them off the jungle floor while constantly having to reach forward for that next vine to move on. You know, Griffin sounded a lot of familiar notes. You know, I think this digital stuff gets to sound all the same after a while. But one thing he said really caught my attention, and that's that he expects publishing is going to move more towards actuarial models, you know, such as radio, where you pay into a pool and then that money is distributed among content owners. Also, a collective licensing, we might call it, words that I know you love to hear at the CCC. Griffin said that if the past has taught us anything, it's that when actual control begins to fail us, we do not answer with more control. And that's a message we've also been hearing a lot more of. But in order for that to happen, Griffin stressed, there really needs to be good, solid international rights registries. So our friend Michael Healy better get cracking on those. Now back to this theme of actual control. We also heard a lot about the anti-DRM shift that we've talked about in previous podcasts. It was very pronounced at London here too. And I'm starting to hear that it's no longer a matter of if, but when most publishers are going to start taking DRM off their ebooks. And that view was especially amplified by Pottermore's Charlie Redmayne, who also spoke at the Digital Minds Conference. DRM doesn't stop piracy, he said. It hampers the consumer experience, and it allows retailers to lock down customers. I think that's starting to become a prevailing wisdom as the ebook market booms.
Well, you know, there was a CEO panel at the fair that's generated some continuing talk. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, I think probably because of the DOJ action, people are really tuned into what's going on in publishing. And lo and behold, here we are in London with a big gathering of publishers. You know how these panels always go. The topic is always presented in some intentionally grandiose and provocative fashion. And this year's topic at the CEO panel was suitably grandiose. It was, can the book industry's business model survive? And all of the CEOs, you know, pretty much gave the same answer, which is, you know, yes, no, kind of, maybe, maybe not. You get the picture. You know, it's a pretty wide open question. But all of the CEOs were pretty insightful, and they did hit on another common theme of the fair this year. And that's that the publishing industry has to shift from an industry that sells to a trade channel to one that builds relationships directly with readers, directly with consumers. At one point, Don Katz, who is the CEO of digital audio publisher Audible, which is also part of Amazon, said there should never be another imprint created by publishers because imprints are designed for the trade. Rather, publishers need to focus more on consumer brand building. My favorite moment of the CEO panel, however, was Richard Sharkin from Bloomsbury, who admonished that publishing was beginning to lose its trust factor. You know, he referenced everything from these contentious discussions about royalty reviews to retailer agreements that are, you know, 10, 20 pages long with confidentiality clauses. You used to be able to trust that people in the publishing industry work. That trust is starting to fade, and regaining that trust is going to be essential to move forward. I think, you know, Richard has a point with that.
Well, you know, growing up in Boston, Andrew, we were taught to trust everybody, but always cut the cards. And I think that in the discussion of trust, there's a name that looms that almost nobody would trust at this point, unfortunately, and that's Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon is certainly facing what we might call a little bit of a trust deficit, shall we say. But I have to say, I was very struck by Amazon's presence at this year's fair. And maybe that's because all this DOJ stuff is so fresh. It just all happened a week ago, and it's fresh in everybody's mind. I think, but while most publishers are still trying to sort out what's happening with the U.S. and what's going on with these price-fixing charges, you know, Amazon is just, you know, going ahead gangbusters. At the London Book Fair, they announced that they're going to be republishing through Kindle Publishing the entire James Bond series, through Amazon Publishing, excuse me. That's kind of a huge deal, and I'm going to be very interested to see how well they do with that. And their Kindle Direct Self-Publishing unit had its own booth and held three very popular, overflowing, I'll say, sessions. I have to say, self-publishing was a big deal this year at the London Book Fair, and that surprised me. It was got markedly more play than it has in previous years. There were a ton of programs with titles like Why Self-Publishing is Not Only the Future, but the Present, Serious Self-Publishing from Manuscript to Market, and Ebooks for the Self-Published Author. You know, authors have always come to the London Book Fair, you know, not in huge numbers. I think just over 1,000 attendees of the 25,000 who came last year were identified as authors, first and foremost. But I think as technology makes publication easier, at least getting to market easier, and makes marketing more effective, you have things like social networks, et cetera, to push things out. I think you're going to see a lot more authors start to come to book fairs, especially if they can, you know, learn about best practices or new skills, potentially meet an agent, or find an alternate route to market, whether it's Amazon or Lulu.com. I think this is a trend worth paying attention to, and Amazon is also going to be at BEA this year, so I'm sure they're going to have some more announcements there.
Well, we will look for them there, and I think you're making a terrific point about self-publishing. And of course, one has to ask about what kind of a book fair it is if it becomes more and more about self-published books. But indeed, that was a subject for one more discussion. Again, it's a book fair, so there'll be plenty of that. This was the Great Debate, which was a program that featured my colleague Michael Healy from Copyright Clearance Center.
Yeah, this was the second year that they've done this, and I think already in its second year, it's probably the most popular program that takes place at the London Book Fair. And as you mentioned, yeah, it's moderated by, you know, Copyright Clearance Center's Michael Healy and Daily Lit's Susan Danziger. They do a terrific job. And this year, the Great Debate topic, like the CEO panel, was also one of these great grandiose things. It was essentially, will the upstarts displace traditional publishing? Will they? In fact, I believe the word they used was knock out traditional publishing. But that offered some great exposure for the self-publishing sector, because arguing for the resolution, that means arguing for the fact that these upstarts were going to knock out big publishing, were Lulu.com CEO Bob Jung and Wattpad's Alan Lau, two of the very big self-publishing firms out there. Now, obviously, the debate topic was meant to be provocative. And in the final tally, the resolution was defeated. Publishing will live to fight another day. But I will say this, there is certainly, as reflected in that topic, a real sense of self-publishing coming on, and a real sense of self-publishing's place in the overall ecosystem. On one hand, self-publishing, or as Amazon has branded it, independent publishing, stands to be a great benefit to the publishing industry. You know, it's virtually impossible to get unsolicited manuscripts to an agent or a publisher these days. So self-publishing not only offers a way to expose writers whose work might never find its way off the slush pile, it also offers editors and agents a chance to see how a work is going to be received by an audience and just how industrious these authors are and how they're going to work to make their own books sell. But self-publishing also offers some challenges to these publishers. Amazon, for example, is offering higher royalty rates. In fact, all these firms are offering higher royalty rates, flexible pricing, and very quick-to-market publication times. Now, is this going to kill publishing? No. But innovation in the self-publishing arena is almost certainly going to pressure traditional publishers to adapt some of their practices and policies sooner rather than later, or they're, you know, at risk of ceding this very lucrative part of the reading business to these new upstarts and to Amazon. And I think especially when it comes to pricing, you're going to see that be a very touchy issue, because you see the self-publishers who are very willing to accept that they'll sell an ebook at 99 cents. Publishing gasps at the notion of selling a 99 cent ebook. But self-publishing, no problem. And a lot of these people are doing very well with that.
Well, Andrew, I think everything you're saying is really insightful. And I can tell you that you've got some company in thinking of the value of self-publishing moving forward. We just had a conversation with Robert Gottlieb, one of the top agents in the business. And frankly, he has found a number of now best-selling authors for print books and other kind of publisher deals right from that new slush pile that's called self-publishing. And so
that's right. They're out there. You know, one of my favorite moments at the fair this year was when I got to meet this author, Rachel Abbott, who published with Kindle Direct. Her book, Only the Innocent, hit number one in the UK Kindle store and has now sold over 100,000 copies. And this is just in a few months, and very much owing to her hard work and her savvy. I think we're going to see a lot more authors like Rachel Abbott in the future. And I think that is going to change, not kill publishing. And frankly, I believe competition is good. So I think things are going to change for the better.
Well, Andrew Albanese coming to us this week from Earl's Court in Kensington, London at the London Book Fair. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And now joining us from New York City at the Publishers Weekly offices is Rose Fox, who blogs at Genreville. Rose, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you back. As always, you've got the review of the reviews. We started out with fiction, and there were several debuts this week.
That's right. We have Elsewhere California. This is Dana Johnson's debut novel, and it cycles between the past and present of a compelling character named Avery. She will be familiar to readers of Johnson's Flannery O'Connor award-winning collection Break Any Woman Down. I think this is her first appearance at novel length. And our reviewer says that Johnson has an honest, compassionate, and unflinching willingness to honor teenage struggles for identity, confidence, and love. We also review Wife 22. This is the superb first novel by Melanie Gideon. The reviewer says it artfully traces the contours of a dull marriage in the age of Facebook, but the debut glimmers even though the marriage is dull. We also cover The World Without You by Joshua Henkin. He's the head of the Brooklyn College MFA program, and in this tender novel, he explores the ties that not only bind but lacerate, and he creates a sympathetic cast of characters that the reader will love spending time with. We also have Alexander McCall Smith's latest, A Conspiracy of Friends. This is the third book in the Corduroy Mansion series, and the reviewer says it may be short on plot, but it is teeming with charm. We also have a Q&A with the fantastic Paget Powell. We talked about his book last week. He's a Southern scribe extraordinaire, and he discusses his latest book, You and Me, in which two old men argue on a front porch. And in the Q&A, he talks about writing close to the bone, indiscretion, and not having the courage to feed his dog a steak and put him on a sit command next to a hole and shoot him when the dog began to lose it. In the mystery thriller section, we have Mala Nunn's Blessed Are the Dead. This is her gripping third mystery set in 1950s South Africa, in which Detective Sergeant Emmanuel Cooper looks into the murder of a teenage Zulu girl. And the local doctor is oddly reluctant to help with the examination. We also have Oliver Potch's The Dark Monk, A Hangman's Daughter Tale. This is the German author's second mystery set in 17th century Bavaria. When a parish priest dies after eating poisoned honey donuts, the local hangman and his daughter, who's an apprentice midwife, investigate. Our mystery Q&A is with John Katzenbach, author of What Comes Next, which is about a retired university professor diagnosed with dementia who tries to save a teenage girl kidnapped by a couple who run a website where viewers can watch horrors inflicted on victims in real time.
Well, in the science fiction, fantasy, and horror section, Rose, there's a book out that explores an aspect of culture that I'm not familiar with and don't think I'm ever really going to go too deeply into it, but you know much about it. Steampunk.
Yeah, we have the Mammoth Book of Steampunk, edited by Sean Wallace, and it really lives up to its name. As people think of steampunk as being, you know, I glued some gears on this, or, you know, it's a...
That's exactly what I think it is.
Well, it's just what happens when goths discover brown. You know, people dress up in these sort of Victorian costumes and take tea and, you know, sort of pretend they're living in a past when you could be really independent and innovative. And what this book is doing, actually, which I think is terrific, is it really goes beyond that. It goes beyond what's superficial and uses steampunk to critique and explore both the past and the present. There's a lot of dialogue going on right now in the steampunk subculture about, for example, the colonial side of the Victorian era, a time when explorers were taking what they thought of as culture and civilization to what they thought of as benighted places, and the people already living in those benighted places didn't necessarily appreciate it. So there are stories in this book that are set all over the world. It's not just in London with clockwork, and it's actually a really exciting overview of what's going on in the genre right now, both from a fiction perspective and from what I would call a political perspective. Also in the science fiction section, we have Daniel Wilson's Amped. This explores a dystopian future where people with brain implants are stigmatized and attacked until they decide to fight back. In the romance section, we have Kira Brady's Hearts of Darkness. This is a smashing paranormal romance debut. It draws on Norse and Native American mythology to create a grim alternate present-day Seattle where shapeshifters battle soul-eaters over a doorway to another plane. And we've got a Q&A with Brady coming up in a forthcoming issue. Also, Philippa Ashley's Just Say Yes. This is a sweet and incisive critique of the goldfish bowl of modern culture, seen through the eyes of a woman who is shocked when her lover proposes marriage to her on live television. In the comic section, we have Everything We Miss by Luke Pearson. He uses cartoon-faced everyman to explore what it means to try to be human and maintain meaningful relationships in what our reviewer says is a devastating story that resonates in the subconscious.
And coming up in nonfiction, you've got a posthumous volume from Howard Zinn, who's best known for The People's History of the United States.
This book is called The Historic Unfulfilled Promise, which is how Zinn described democracy, and it is a posthumous collection of articles that he published in Progressive magazine, many of which argue for alternatives to war and ideals of egalitarianism, community, and self-determination. And Zinn was just a brilliant political commentator. Some of his early articles seem incredibly prescient, and this is a really valuable collection that our reviewer said will have particular resonance for the occupiers of the present political generation.
Well, he was a Boston area resident, and I saw him several times speaking at writers' engagements, and he always cut a rather rakish figure and really magnetic one, so we can look forward to that. Gail Collins, the New York Times columnist, has a book out as well.
She does. In the tradition of Molly Ivins, the late wonderful Texas political commentator, Collins slathers plenty of wry humor onto a critique that stings like a red-hot brand, says the review. of As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. And this is her analysis of how Texan models of public policy inspired the Republican Party's national platform, even when those models were not necessarily successful. Less politically, more sensitively, perhaps, we have Paul Auster's memoir, Winter Journal, is a quietly moving meditation on death and life, a chronicle of both the momentous and the mundane. We also have three books by and about top chefs, one from the 19th century, one from the 20th century, and one whose career is still going strong today.
In Chilvins, there's a lot of love on display this week.
There is. We pretty much explore every aspect of family love. There are seven picture books about parents, but many of those are about parents who are separated, about having different homes and, you know, parents, you know, moms and dads and the difference between them. And it's a really interesting range for kids who come from families of all kinds. We also have a review of A Home for Bird by Philip C. Stead, which describes an unusual friendship between a tender-hearted frog and a stuffed bird toy. Between the Lines is the first collaboration between best-selling author Jodi Picoult and her teen daughter Samantha Van Leer. This is in the fiction section, and it's a clever YA romance between a lonely girl and one of the characters in her favorite book. And bringing the romance and the family themes together is Keeping the Castle by Patrice Kendall. This is a sharp-witted comedy of manners that recalls the work of Jane Austen, and it has a standout heroine who is looking for love, but she's doing it to take care of her family, even though her stepsisters would rather sit around all day than contribute. And our reviewer says she displays remarkable ingenuity and compassion. She's really a heroine that every reader will want to identify with. In our online annex, Daniel Levin-Becker explores the history of ULPO, that's short for Ouvre de Littérature Potentielle, or the Workshop for Potential Literature. That is one of the 20th century's most bizarre and charming literary movements, and the book is called Many Subtle Channels in Praise of Potential Literature. And Robert Santelli digs into the history and mythology of Woody Guthrie's most iconic folk song in This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. Finally, our pick of the week is The Chemistry of Tears by Peter Carey. This goes back a little bit to the steampunk theme. It follows two stories simultaneously. One is a Victorian man who wants a clockwork duck to amuse his very ill son. And the other is a modern-day woman who is grieving the death of her lover, and she focuses obsessively on repairing the clockwork duck, which she has found.
Well, Rose Fox, who blogs at Charmerville, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, happy anniversary. We understand you've been at PW for 5 years now.
That's right. I've been an editor here for 5 years, and I was a reviewer 5 years before that. So it's 10 years altogether that I've been drawing the red paycheck, and I'm happier than ever here. It's really a wonderful place to be. So thank you very much for the congratulations.
All right, indeed. Rose Fox, thank you again. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.